How can I tell the difference between a muscle strain and a joint issue?
That's a great question. It can be really difficult, actually. So the classic would be a forelimb lameness that's isolating to the shoulder area. It can be very difficult to determine, you know, is it something with the joint? And sometimes it can be kind of both. So classic would be what's called bicipital tenosynovitis. So that's inflammation of the biceps tendon, which runs through the shoulder joint. So it's kind of a soft tissue injury that's in a joint. Joint disease typically is going to have radiographic signs is really the easy answer. So you're like, for example, an ACL tear. So that's technically a soft tissue injury, but it's in a joint and it causes joint instability. So when you take a radiograph of that, you're going to see signs of intra-articular disease. The first sign you're going to see is a fusion of fluid. And then as things progress, you're going to see various stages of OA or arthritis. Whereas soft tissue injuries are typically not going to give you any joint changes. So you take a radiograph and let's say it's, a gastroc pull or, you know, some muscle pull around the knee that pain isolates to the knee, but it's not the knee joint that's the problem. You take a radiograph of the knee joint, you should not see a bunch of OA in the knee joint
right.
if it's a gastroc pull or something like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you just mentioned ACL. Do ACLs always need an MRI?
ACLs actually almost never need an MRI. And please, if your veterinarian is insisting on an MRI to diagnose an ACL, I would question if they knew what they were doing. I'm sorry, that doesn't sound political.
No, it's honest.
It's honest because, you know, occasionally, like maybe you could argue like a meniscal damage or a very small ACL tear that's really difficult to feel, possibly. Most of the time, you're going to be able to feel, like 99% of the time, you're going to be able to feel what's called cranial drawer. So that's right. Sliding the tibia forward in relation to the femur. If you feel that instability at all in a mature animal, just like with us, we know that that ACL is torn to some degree. The biggest mistake most people make is they don't check for partial tears.
Right.
So when you check for drawer, they check for with the knee in extension, but they don't, and they get no drawer. So, oh, it's not the ACL. No. You have to check with the knee in flexion. And if you get instability in flexion and not extension, that's diagnostic for a partial ACL tear. Again, you don't need an MRI for that. That's it. It's done.
Right.
You're done. You have a diagnosis.
And you also see it radiographically most of the time.
You will not see ACL radiographically.
No, I mean, if you will see swelling in the joint.
You will see changes in the joint. Absolutely.
Yes.
It would be almost impossible to not have some degree of effusion in the knee joint with an ACL injury. Now, really early partial, small partial tears, it can be hard to see the effusion. It's a small amount. And you have to know exactly where to look. It kind of creeps right up behind the patella. And there's a nice paper showing that. Yes, you should have some changes in the joint if there's an ACL issue, but it's not diagnostic. So we have to keep in mind all of those changes are nonspecific for ACL disease. Anything causing inflammation in that knee joint is going to give you the same exact radiographic signs.
Right.
It just happens to be most of the times an ACL.
Right.
What about the concept of having clients, the importance of having clients videotape the limp?
Almost never helpful. It can be helpful to kind of, for me anyway, maybe I just am lousy at looking at gates, but it tells me, nope, it's not the left back leg, it's the right front leg.
Right.
It tells me, oh, that's really severe, like holding the leg up, like, oh, this, you know, this is significant versus, oh, that's a very subtle lameness.
Right.
So degree of lameness, it helps for me. It helps typically, yes, it's confirmed. Yes, it's the right back leg. Usually people that send videos of lameness, it's because the lameness is subtle.
Right.
You're not sending a three-legged dog walking video because everyone can kind of pick that up.
Yeah.
So the subtle lamenesses are difficult for me anyway to really get a handle because, A, the videos are almost always at very odd angles.
Yeah.
Dogs, you know, the dogs are going all these different directions and it's not controlled. And
my favorite one is I had one where the dog was literally across the dog park and they're videotaping it.
They're like, can you see?
Can you see?
And there's like 10 other dogs.
Yeah.
It's fun.
And you're like zooming in. It gets all granular. So if you are going to videotape, just like with pictures, just try to get a good video. something that we could look at and make something of? Because we can use it. I use it a lot as a diagnostic tool.
More information is never bad. I mean, you'd never be like, God, I really wish I didn't get that video.
Yeah.
It may not be as helpful as you'd want. But it's never wrong or bad to have more information. It's fantastic. And I also just throw one more thing in. Like, hopefully most people can crop videos now in terms of, like, edit videos.
Yeah.
Very commonly, I'll get, like, literally a three-minute video, which doesn't sound like a long time, but that's a very long time.
Yeah. And it's the 20-second portion.
The last
portion,
20 seconds is when the dog stands up and walks.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I'm like, you know, or at least put in, like, 2 minutes, 40 seconds in, that's what you want to watch.
Right, this is what we're going for.
You know what I mean? Just selfish saves me some time.
Are there orthopedic issues that don't show up on x-rays?
Oh, yeah. Lots of them. Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. So soft tissue injuries, you almost never see changes radiographically. Yeah, it's usually bone joint changes that you're going to see radiographically.
We had a couple people questioning, what's the difference between X-rays and more advanced imaging like CT or MRI?
Yeah. If you want to answer
that.
You're more than qualified to answer all these. X-ray is just going to be that standard. X-ray is technically incorrect because X-rays are the radiation that is causing the exposure, either digitally or old school, you know, with the film.
Right.
But the radiograph is what we're looking at.
Right.
And that is, it's really looking at, two-dimensional bone joint, some soft tissue, and that's the classic. It's been around for decades.
What I told clients, it's a 2D image of a 3D problem.
Right.
Correct.
So you got everything layered on top of it. So our joke always, in the profession is like, sometimes you got to put on your imaginoscope and see if you see something.
Yeah. And dealing with that issue, like you said, Dr. G, the importance of multiple views is apparent. So a lot of people go, why did you have to take 3 views, 4 views, 5 views? It's because of this exact issue. We're trying to figure something out that's three-dimensional with a two-dimensional picture.
Right.
Which is a perfect segue to the CT. So CT is three-dimensional. So it's an X-ray still, same technology, except it's basically a rotating radiation where you get 360 view of whatever anatomy you're trying to look at.
Yep. And they're sliced at like 2 millimeters.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it goes, first it will go from right to left, and then the second time it'll go from top to bottom or bottom to top, however it's set up.
Yeah.
But you'll get, then that way you can get that 3D image.
Absolutely. It gives you so much more information. The CT is fantastic. And it's very quick.
Yeah.
These new ones, helicals, 5 minutes or whatever.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So a lot of them you can just do with heavy sedation.
Yeah.
It's just the cost is usually, although sometimes radiographs are... Mm-hmm.
Radiographs are crazy. There, right? Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
So, and we also had a mobile CT person who would come, right? So again, that kind of goes back to the mobile aspect of it, of just being able to get it done in your clinic.
Yeah, the Long Island one, shout out for them. I use them too. Thankfully, now where I am, we have a CT and an MRI because the neurologist is there too. But the mobile is a nice option for the GPs for sure.
Yeah. We had a client run into our CTs. Damage the steps.
Well, that parking lot was challenging.
It was. It was an awful parking lot. But after that, I was like PTSD calling every time we had to call the CT guy. I was like, oh.
But you get a lot of information out of a CT.
Yeah. Actually, sometimes too much. So you're doing
finding problems you didn't even know existed.
Exactly. So you do what's called staging or MET checks of the lungs. And, and people, they were too sensitive. You know, the little pulmonary osteomas and all this stuff, and they see them on CTs, and they're like, geez, is that lung cancer, or are they just benign little nodules? And then some of these people would have been fine not doing anything, but they're through the gamut of lung biopsies and all this stuff. And if you just didn't do the CT, you wouldn't have had to go through that. The flip side to that argument would be, you found something early on.
Correct.
And you caught it early.
Correct.
So, it's a balance.
Which is huge. That happened to a friend of ours with breast cancer. She demanded an MRI instead of a mammogram, and they picked up breast nodules early because the mammogram read it as dense tissue.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, so MRI gives you a whole different technology, and it gives you as much or more information as a CT scan, except the general sort of rule is MRIs are better for soft tissue and neuroimaging, and CT is better for orthopedic bone joint imaging. Just as a rough rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sedated, not sedated.
MRI is always going to be general anesthesia because it takes forever.
Yeah. I mean,
they're better now, but there's typically no real quick MRI. They take a while. Yeah.
Most time x-rays can be not sedated, or also depending on the issue.
Well, the state of California has passed that law, correct?
That's right.
Oh, you tell me.
Yeah, they passed the law that all x-rays done in a veterinary clinic, the animal needs to be sedated because he would want to lessen radiation to the staff.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. Before you open your brick and mortar. Can cats have a luxating patella, or is it mostly a dog issue?
Yes and yes.
Cats can have it, and it is mostly a dog problem.
Absolutely, yeah. So cats, very rarely, but they definitely, I've done maybe 50, 100 or something that in 20 years, yeah.
So, not many, I mean, in 20 years, that's not many.
Yeah, it's not a lot. Yeah, I mean, definitely, no, that's too much. It's definitely less than, maybe one or two a year, I guess.
Okay.
For my practice. Anyway.
Yeah.
So usually they can have mega patella, so those patellas are just too big for the groove.
Okay.
And so it's usually more of a congenital sort of thing like that, whereas dogs, it's almost always an alignment issue.
Yeah.
So luxating patella basically is when the kneecap moves on and off. And sometimes there's different grades. Obviously, the patella is very important to stabilize that knee joint. If it's not all luxating patellas are surgical.
Correct. So, yeah. So patella luxation is the patella leaving the trochlear groove. So that's popping out of the groove that it's supposed to run up and down in on the knee joint. Yeah, absolutely. And so grade ones, if you say, I just did surgery on a grade one patella, I'd question, what are you doing? So grade one means that they never come out on their own. They never pop out on their own. It's just physically manipulating them. You can luxate them.
Right. Okay.
So they're never clinical. They're never symptomatic. And some people argue, well, it might increase in grade and cause a problem down the future. But I don't know about that. Whereas twos, threes, and fours can definitely be clinical, cause orthopedic issues for sure. And depending on what you read, I tend to believe that it also will increase risk for ACL disease.
Right.
Tears. Yeah.
I agree too.
Yeah. That's it? That's all you got? You just agree?
No, I agree. I used to see a ton of ACLs on dogs whose patella had popped out a joint.
Right.
And then they make that sharp turn like a running back, right? Mm-hmm. And boom.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of, when the kneecap's luxating, there's a lot of rotational instability. And one of the constraints for internal rotation of the knee is the ACL. And right. So if you have a malalignment where you're getting a lot more internal rotation that is normal, you're going to put more strain on that ligament that is normal. Yeah.
What's the success rate of luxating patella surgery?
I feel like every question you ask, I say, well, it depends.
But I mean, I think it's good for viewers to hear that. I mean, medicine is different, case to case, breed to breed.
Nothing straightforward.
No. So I think sometimes people are like, oh, I'm getting the runaround, and you're not. I mean, there really isn't.
Just being honest, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a straight-up answer or a broad answer for everybody.
So let's say you do a patella surgery on a grade one, like we just talked about. I would say that's close to 100% success rate. You could question the need for the surgery in the first place, but that surgery is going to do, they're going to do really
fine.
Well.
You're good.
Because they weren't limping in the first place.
Right.
But then you could argue, oh, well, I prevented a problem in the future. And again, you could argue about that, but so then it really just depends on a couple of main factors. One would be the size of the dog.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, a 10 pounder versus a 200 pounder, we're dealing with a very different situation in terms of the forces that you have to counteract with your surgery. And typically we're doing what's called a tuberosity transposition, where we're realigning the insertion of the patellar tendon. Cause that's usually the main issue is why they're luxating. And so basically you are moving the insertion of the patellar tendon, which is the insertion of basically all of the quads. So when you extend your knee, just like in us, you extend your knee, all of your quads are focused to one little bitty point on the front of your tibia, which most people call their shin bone. So that right below your knee, that little bony prominence. And so we've just cut that and moved it. So you can imagine a 200-pound dog versus a 10-pound dog. So there's a big difference in terms of complication rate and the forces that we have to counteract. And then lateral versus medial. So lateral patella luxations definitely have a higher complication rate than medial. Thankfully, laterals are pretty rare.
Yeah.
It's almost always medial. And then you could also argue, well, laterals are almost always going to be larger dogs. So right. is it just the laterality of the patella luxation, or is it just because they're larger dogs, or is it both?
Right.
Probably both. So then it's the degree of the deformity, malalignment, and the grade of the patella. So I've done a fair number of little, and every veterinarian probably knows these little chihuahuas that I call them grade fives, actually.
Yeah.
So their kneecap is basically behind their knee.
Yeah. Right.
And there's nothing straight about their leg at all.
Yeah.
Very bow-legged look.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a little bow-legged.
For ornamentation only, not for walking.
I mean,
these things, you know, these knees are a mess. So the degree of correction you need to do for that sort of dog is going to be very different than something for like a grade two.
Right.
So really it just depends on the degree of your, what you're trying to correct for sure. And also the chronicity, like most surgeries, like, so chronicity, you know, how severe something is. So if that kneecap has been out the entire time of the dog's life and the dog is 10 years old.
Right.
Which I've come across many times.
It's hard to fix.
So those are almost always grade fours, meaning that the kneecap is frozen in an abnormal position because of scar tissue. So that scar is all just lock that kneecap where it is. And you physically can't move it back into the groove.
Right.
So you have to do what's called medial release. You have to cut all of that scar tissue that's had 10 years to form, all that scar tissue down just to physically move the knee back to where it needs to be.
Yeah.
And so if you're dealing with something like that, you know, it's very different than, you know, grade two or three. So,
right.
Yeah. So I guess to answer your question, the success rate could be very, very high, like 95% plus, versus, you know, maybe even in the 70-80%, depending, you know, for the worst ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your recommendation on when to fix luxating patella?
So I'm very practical and pragmatic. I'm not a super aggressive surgeon, so I'm aggressive when I need to be, I guess I'd like to say. But so grade ones I would never cut, personally.
Right.
So, you know, the dog has never limped ever, and it's a grade one, I say just watch it. And if it progresses to a two, then causing a quality of life issue, then yeah,
right.
we can cut it then. It's not like, oh, you didn't cut it then, you lose your window of opportunity. You can always do it later. And then for twos, threes, and fours, I typically will recommend surgery. And it really just depends on, again, the quality of life. So some twos, they'll pop out for 5 seconds every 3 months.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, you can, but I'm not super excited about that. But we can certainly correct it if it's causing an issue.
Yeah.
Versus it pops out 15 times every walk.
Right.
And he's hobbling around. That's an easy recommendation to do surgery.
You know?
So that's kind of how, and I always kind of throw in the risk of ACL injury. So ones, I don't think that's true, but twos on up. I can also say, the benefit of surgery will be to decrease the risk of ACL disease in the future. However, it doesn't go to zero. I've had plenty of dogs with corrected kneecaps tear their ACLs still.
Right.
So. And if your veterinarian says your dog does have a luxating patella, you would not be in the wrong to, number one, get a second opinion, but also start Adequan, Cosequin, fish oils, something to help protect the joints. Just because no matter what you do, whether you do surgery or not, that joint's going to get arthritis because it's not a joint that Mother Nature had ever intended.
Right.
But at least with the right nutraceuticals, you have a good chance of slowing down the arthritis formation.
Yeah, where they get the cartilage issue with patellas is the medial ridge. So the medial ridge is nice hyaline cartilage, but over time, that kneecap in and out, in and out, in and out, it wears down to subchondral bone, and that triggers inflammation, which we call osteoarthritis. So all that stuff can definitely help. It won't hurt.
Yeah.
For sure.
What are the different types of elbow dysplasia?
So the classic elbow dysplasia is what's called cornoid disease. So there's a cornoid process of the ulna. It's a little cradle for the radial head for when you supinate pronate. And that little bony projection can get fractured and fragmented. We now know it's definitely trauma. Back when I was going through residency, the concern was that it was an OCD lesion. Mm-hmm. And that's been pretty much disproven. It is a fracture trauma situation. And what's happening is the elbow doesn't quite fit together properly. So there's a little bit of incongruity. And then that little bony prominence is kind of proud and seeing abnormal force. And then it fractures and fragments over time. So that's by far the most common elbow dysplasia manifestation. The other three, actually. One would be what's called UAP, so ununited anchoidal process. So that is
genetic.
Yep, genetic. And in larger dogs, you typically it's going to have a secondary ossification center, meaning that it has basically a separate growth plate. And so it has to fuse with the rest of the ulna. And for whatever reason, sometimes that doesn't happen. Again, usually incongruity. That will fail to fuse with the rest of the ulna, and then you have this big kind of triangle piece of bone that's loose in the joint. And they don't like that. Doesn't feel good. German Shepherds are classic, and they actually will have a delayed fusion of that. So most dogs, that'll be fused at about 16 weeks, except for German Shepherds. So I've had a lot of referrals for UAPs for Shepherds, and they're 16 weeks. I'm like, I got to wait 20 weeks for those guys. So you don't want to jump the gun with the German Shepherds. And then where the third one is OCD. So that's cartilage flap disorder, cartilage disorder. It's usually on the medial aspect of the humerus. And then the fourth one is epicondylar issue. That's some people, you know, most people put that in the, you know, the dysplasia grouping, but that's pretty rare. It's usually Labradors. It's kind of like an epicondylar lack of fusion of the epicondyle of the humerus.
One question I used to get a lot is, I have my 60-pound lab. At what point is it safe to take them for runs with me?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess it depends on how long the runs are and on what.
Yeah. Right.
But I would say when they're full grown is an easy answer. If they're full grown.
18 months once the growth plates are done?
I mean, long bone growth typically is over around 8-9 months in large breed dogs. The long bone growth, the certain, like the tuberosity actually usually will take 14 to 16 months. But the long bones are usually done growing, not fully closed, but they're done growing, around 8-9 months, something like that. So I'd say, like 9-10 months, 12 months, something like that.
Right.
And I would
start-stop stuff, not like long-term.
Yeah, I mean,
we had a client that was an ultra-marathoner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
And she was like, we're ready to go. My dogs want to go fit. And I was like, oh, my gosh, 15 miles a day.
I mean, stuff wears out. And, you know, the longer you're running and the more, firm the surface that you're running on, it's going to cause some micro damage over time. I would say I wouldn't get a great Dane and expect them to be a great running partner.
Right.
Or like a little Chihuahua or something. Get a running dog. Right. Get a dog built for running. And there's a lot of them. If you want to run with your dog, there's some breeds that are more.
Don't buy a Frenchie and go running.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when it's 110 degrees outside.
Right.
That won't go well. If you have running, don't expect, if you have like a football player dog, don't expect him to be a marathon runner.
Right.
And vice versa. So.
Kind of just going off of the bulldog here, and since you do surgery, soft palate and stenotic nares. How do you feel about getting those done in these brachiocephalic breeds or these smushed-faced breeds?
I know.
Dr. Gene, probably, you go ahead, man. You've probably done more than I have.
Well, they started a bulldog genome project up in Davis, and immediately they brought in 3,900 bulldogs and pulled blood on them. And within a month, they found that most of these bulldogs, or basically the smush face breeds, the ones who won the 50-yard dash and a 40-yard gym,
they
the ones that have difficulty breathing are the ones that also have the exact same issues that sleep apnea people have.
Right.
So most of the time you see the overweight Frenchie, the overweight bulldog, the overweight pug, the overweight Boston Terrier, it's because they can't breathe. People who have sleep apnea have a hard time losing weight. And so the one thing they recommended immediately is if you see a bulldog, a Frenchie, English bulldog, Boston, even English or bull mastiff, open up that airway at time of spay or neuter. And you really can't see back there at the palate unless you're asleep anyways.
Right.
So that was number one.
You can hear it.
You can hear it. You definitely can hear it. The second thing is that they found that these bulldogs that have issues with breathing usually don't go into slow kidney failure. They go into acute, rampant kidney failure. Huh. They're prone to brain tumors. They're prone to pulmonary hypertension. They're prone to heart disease. So for me, it is I had that conversation all the time because Frenchies are now the most popular breed.
Yeah.
And what I always used to tell them is like, imagine your life breathing through a McDonald's straw. So that's the size of their trachea. Then I would tell them, take that McDonald's straw and cover half of it with a piece of scotch tape. Because that now is a soft palate.
Right.
Now, as you're breathing through that straw that with that tape on it, I want you to close your nose just a little bit.
Right. Plug one nostril.
Right. Or just close them just a touch.
Yeah.
That is exactly how they feel breathing.
Yeah. They are not set up for success, are they?
No. But it can be fixed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It can be fixed. So I'll let you discuss the fiction.
No, that was interesting. And bulldogs have a lot of challenges. I think Frenchies are, you tell me what you think, but in my experience, Frenchies seem to be way less severely affected in general than the big English bulldog in general. They can have it really rough too. But for my, and again, I've seen less than you, but English bulldogs seem to be the most challenging breed for me for airway, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's the 8-year-old, morbidly obese, been partially obstructed for 8 years dog that has probably some degree of pneumonia, some degree.
Always.
Yep.
Always has some degree of pneumonia.
Some degree of hypoplastic trachea, some degree of horrible, you know, intraoral swelling, airway swelling going on. That those are the ones that I've had trouble with, and maybe I'm just not as good as you are, but those are the ones that I set them up for postoperative obstruction. And I have colleagues that actually will just preemptively do temporary tracheostomies with those airways.
Wow.
Because they've had so many of them obstruct afterwards.
And that's why it's so important to do when early. It's young.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I was getting at is that's a great point, is that, you know, when they're young without all these secondary changes, I think definitely English bulldogs, it would not be wrong to just trim them right away.
Yeah.
Something else I'm going to add.
Yeah.
The dogs, I read a research article. The bulldogs that have issues breathing, they're also prone to hiatal hernia. That's the cause of the hiatal hernia.
Yeah.
So when you have your young bulldog that gets aspiration pneumonia,
right,
it's probably because they can't breathe.
Yeah.
And it's not like life-threatening can't breathe, but there's a partial obstruction that is anatomically created. And, you know, everyone always says, you know, bulldogs, French bulldogs, are all anesthetic nightmares, or, you know, you got to be careful. The beautiful thing was when we would go in there and open up the airway postoperatively, they're looking at you smiling.
Mm-hmm. We would always joke that they go into stealth mode because pre-surgery you have all those wonderful bulldog noises. And then they were like leaving, you know, leaving to go home, and you couldn't even hear him walking down the hallway. Yeah. And you were like, oh my gosh, this little guy's in stealth mode now. He's ready to go.
Yeah, when they go well, it's really rewarding.
Oh, very rewarding. Yes. Yeah.
And I've gotten progressively more and more aggressive with the amount of palate I remove. They always say, you know, don't remove too much because you're going to have reflux rhinitis and have chronic nasal issues, which you can have if you take way too much. But I honestly, I'd rather have that than them swelling and obstructing after surgery. So I've gotten more and more aggressive. Right.
But how do they know? Because old bulldogs are prone to allergies anyways, and they always get the runny nose, runny eyes,
Have you seen? I mean, they literally have food coming up into their nose.
No, knock on wood.
Yeah. No.
So you've never been too aggressive. I haven't, I don't think, either, but it can be bad.
Just so you know, the incisions in the middle of the tonsils. That's where I go.
That's the textbook landmark is mid-tonsil. Exactly.
Yeah.
All
right,
Dr. G.
Thank you.
We did a lot of them. We somehow got.
I know.
We used to do 5 or 6 a week.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. We had some bulldog rescues that we worked with, and then we kind of just became like the soft palate bulldog place to go. And but I mean, I can tell you, they did great.
It's awesome.
So
I mean,
awesome.
It's
you don't have to worry about, like, the problem is that when they come out of anesthesia and their palate's too long, they're still sedated. So talking about bad sleep apnea, that soft palate can cut off that trachea. Yeah.
I mean, we used to, recovering bulldogs, you know, we would leave trach tubes in until they're like standing, looking at you, meds have worn off, they're like ready
they
to
love
eat.
It.
And you're
they
like,
love
okay.
it. They're smiling with a trach tube.
But you will never see a happier bulldog than with a trach tube
in. Miserable.
But it's amazing. I mean, you're intubating these bulldogs with fours, four and a half, like what we intubate cats with.
Yeah, cat.
Right?
You have to sometimes put cat trachea tubes into bulldogs.
Yeah.
Because that trachea is so small.
Yeah, I think they're against the law to breed them. I think England, Denmark, some European country, I think they've passed a law where you cannot breed bulldogs.
But they're just too big of a mess now. Yeah. We've just created
such a mess. The argument is it's inhumane.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if they don't open up, you just open up the airway.
Yeah.
You'll be very happy you did.
Yeah. I mean, mine's a Frenchie mix, and Dr. G was getting ready to retire, and I was like,
yeah,
guess who's doing my soft palate? And he's like, I'm going to do it the day before I leave. And I was like, 10 days before you leave, so that way if we have any complications, right. I'm coming back. But she would, like, barely pant on a walk, you know? Great. And I was like, you know, I don't know if I really want to deal with this long term. And now she's, like, total stealth, and I love it.
Yeah, now it's, like, sooner the better. It's a lot easier. They're going to do a lot better. And you just do the classic cut and sew?
Cut and sew. Yeah. I used to have a laser. And then I found out that your electrocautery unit that you use does a phenomenal job taking care of it. And then it just...
Oh, so you use the cautery instead of cutting? So you use the cut on the cautery?
Yeah, the cutting portion of the cautery.
Yeah, and then there'd be a little bit of bleeding, but then you just suture it and you're done.
And we would
epiatrophy, getting back to that older bulldog that you would have to do, it's so swollen, there would be a lot of bleeding.
It. Yeah.
I mean, do it when they're young. Yep. We cannot recommend that soon enough.
No, my worst one was I actually used a ligature handpiece because it was the size of my hand. It was so thick.
It was,
and afterwards, I could not believe the amount of swelling after. And that dog needed a trach for sure.
Did it?
And I think 2 weeks or so of a trach, and eventually did okay. But it was a nightmare. Yeah. So I've been scarred by that case.
Yeah. All right, one last
that was
fun
an older one.
Yeah.
One last fun question for you: what's your most memorable surgery?
Oh, jeez.
Or do you have a surgery that really sticks with you that went well, didn't go well, cool species?
Yeah.
Interesting case.
A couple lion surgeries were fun.
Oh, fun.
Did a bald eagle tibial fracture.
Ooh.
And we tried to do an external fixator, which that was probably not a smart call. We were worried
about the talons, dude. No. And now you're giving them another weapon. They got those claws. Now they got this piece of metal.
We were worried about the plate being too heavy and screwing up his flight.
Oh, okay.
So we wanted that's something that we could take off.
Right.
But we ended up plating it. It wasn't good. It ended up working out okay. And it flew a little cattywampus, but it could fly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the plates aren't super heavy. I think we were just overthinking things, but anyway. So that was pretty cool. One cool story was I did a GDV surgery on a bomb-sniffing dog.
Oh, okay.
I think it was New York. I forget where I was. But evidently, the guy called me, the handler or whatever, called me a couple weeks later, and the dog was already working again. And he found, like, a bunch of explosives at this airport.
Oh, wow.
You know? Yeah. And he said that this was their best bomb-sniffing dog. He wasn't sure if the other dogs were going to find it, and this dog did. And so that was kind of cool.
No, that's amazing. Working with service, any type of service animal, is amazing. The bald eagle, breathtaking.
Terrifying.
But breathtaking to see.
Yeah, they're amazing.
All those are – and lions, oof.
What did you do with the lions?
One, it was in New York City with the the circus, and it ate his leash, so it had a linear form body.
Oh gosh!
Yeah, so that was interesting.
Yeah,
and I mean their paws are as big as your head.
Yeah,
and then
intimidating to say the least.
Yeah, and then another one was at a zoo up in Central California, and it had a ovarian cyst and started going nuts because it was some hormonal issues. So we did just a laparoscopic spay, but in a 600-pound lion.
That's
a big
laparoscope.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool. What was interesting is there was a guy standing in the corner of the quote-unquote OR, which is like just basically a big kennel or whatever, with a shotgun. And he was if the lion woke up, that was last resort. He had a shotgun there. And then two people on either side with rabies poles.
Right.
The lion was under anesthesia.
Right.
But these were all their safeguards.
Wow.
Then we had three different exit strategy. So, and they were like little cubby holes. So we could squeeze through, theoretically. I don't know if I could have made it, but theoretically could squeeze through, but too small for the lion. So that was interesting and horrifying.
It gives you a healthy sense of fear.
No, what comes to mind is why did they have all those strategies? Had something happened before?
You don't
just come up with three cubby holes for fun.
I'm thinking
it's anesthesia. So it's like if if our pressures are tanking and we're going to lose the lion, you know, they're lighting up on the anesthesia, and you don't do that. You do it too much, or, you know, they wake up.
Right. Well, and, but my thing is, like, how did they know to have those cubby holes? How did they know they had the guy with the shotgun?
I don't know if there's some horrible, I'm sure there's been close calls.
There has to be.
Trial by fire, right?
Yeah.
Imagine waking up spastically, claws out. I mean, what a nightmare.
Oh, my. Yeah. I mean, I've recovered little pissed off chihuahhas, little pissed off cats.
15-pound cats.
Right. And it's terrifying, right?
They're all, you know, fangs and claws.
Yeah. The zoo I was at didn't have any wild cats. So we had more bears, which are also equally as terrifying. Mm. But, yeah, you have to have an exit strategy. I mean, that's like the number one.
Make sure Mallory tells you about the time that she had to go into the alligator cage.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you after this. It was awful. It was terrifying. I think I was bait, but, you know. Well, that's all we have for you for questions today. Cool. But thank you for coming by.
Pleasure, Dr. Greco.
It was great to see you.
We'll have you again.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back soon.
Yeah, anytime. My pleasure.
And for everybody else, thank you guys for watching another episode of Irreplaceable Tales, and we'll see you soon.